Hi everyone, welcome to The Vandal Theory, a podcast about science and research at the University of Idaho. I'm your host for the day, Kyle Fonensteel, Media Relations Manager here at U of I. I'm joined today by my co-host and longtime podcast host, Lee Cooper.
Hi everyone, I'm Lee Cooper, science writer and editor here at U of I.
Today, we'll talk about how people process political information. So, to kick us off, Lee, what do you think changes people's minds about political issues?
Oh, isn't that the big question that all of our politicians were trying to answer this fall? I mean, I think, one, it is very hard to change people's political minds. And I know we've talked before on this podcast about having someone you trust talk you through it. But beyond that, honestly, I'm not too sure. I know one of the big things that influences kind of your political choices is what you consider your in-group. So whether family, friends, or online community, you oftentimes have the same political views as those people. And breaking away from those views of that group is incredibly difficult. So I'll be interested to hear how our interviewee thinks we can get away from that.
Yes, most definitely. The political science researcher at University of Idaho we're about to talk to, Florian Justwan, was one of my former academic advisors here, and he has looked a lot into this question. And it turns out that quite a bit influences people's minds on political issues. But there's one thing that might surprise you that doesn't influence us so much. Let's talk to Florian. He's steeped in the growing world of political psychology, helping us better understand how our brains process new political information, and today he has some advice for us on how to check our blind spots. Hi, Florian. Thank you so much for coming onto the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
I'm really excited to reconnect with you. Can you tell our listeners a little bit about yourself and what you do?
Yeah, absolutely. So I'm an associate professor in the Department of Politics and Philosophy. I'm originally not from Idaho. I'm from the south of Germany, a very small village an hour north of Munich. I've lived in the States now for over 12 years, and I loved my last 7 years here in Idaho with my wonderful students and wonderful colleagues. My research is on political psychology. So that's a rapidly growing subfield in the field of political science. And in particular, I use psychological perspectives on two sorts of questions. What are people's attitudes towards democracy? And what are people's attitudes towards international law?
So how did you get into this field of research? What brought you here?
I mean, the short answer is it's absolutely amazing and fascinating. The long answer is that political psychology is perhaps one of the most rapidly growing subfields in political science, and psychological explanations for political events and political phenomena are becoming more and more popular and more studied. There are also personal reasons why I really like political psychology. The first thing that I need to note here is a really good friend of mine and my former dissertation advisor, Jeffrey Berzhikian at the University of Georgia, was the first one to introduce me to this scholarship many years ago. And he has an amazing ability to inspire curiosity in his graduate students. Here at U of I, my work has also been strongly influenced and it has anchored me here by a colleague of mine and a good friend of mine, Bert Baumgartner, who is a frequent co-author of mine and an associate professor here in the Department of Politics and Philosophy too.
Why is political psychology gaining so much traction and popularity lately?
I think part of the answer here is that increasingly scholars are getting better at interdisciplinary research. And I think academia is getting better at recognizing scholars who kind of step outside of their silos and learn what the scholarship is in other disciplines. Some institutions are better at this than others, and I'm very happy to say that the University of Idaho is phenomenal when it comes to interdisciplinary research. For interdisciplinary researchers, I cannot imagine a better place than the University of Idaho, really. But it's a growing trend that people are looking beyond very narrow fields and they see what is happening, what is being studied in kind of neighboring disciplines.
As a political psychologist, can you help us understand what you've learned about how people process information?
Yeah, so I would say that at the most fundamental level, people's views about politics and how they process political information are shaped to a large extent by their identities, their character traits, and the social networks that people are part of. So let me very briefly explain what I mean by that. So identities are the social group memberships that people use to define who they are. By character traits, I mean the kind of deep-rooted personality traits that influence people's behaviors and their attitudes. So for example, how anxious or how outgoing are you? And then lastly, by social networks, I mean the groups that people participate in and in which they discuss current affairs.
Can you break that apart a little bit more and just talk about identities? How do they matter?
Yeah, absolutely. So identities, I would say, matter in like sort of two different ways. So first, they directly shape people's opinions on a really large number of concrete political questions. So for instance, in the United States, people who self-identify as conservatives, they are much more likely to be skeptical of government medical agencies such as the CDC. And that, of course, has important implications, as we recently saw during the COVID crisis. But identities don't only matter in the American political context. So in Belize, for instance, the country of Belize, my co-authors and I have found that those people who identify as global citizens, they are much more likely to subject their country to international law than people with different social identities. The second way in which identities matter is more indirect. Identities also influence how we process new political information and how we incorporate this information into our belief structure. So this probably sounds really formal right now, so I can rephrase this a little bit. The phenomenon here is called partisan motivated reasoning. And according to a lot of previous research, this is sort of the default way in which people process new political information. So in short, if you come across information that is challenging to whichever party you identify with, you have a built-in bias to kind of discard and counter-argue that piece of information. But if you come information that is favorable to whichever party you identify with, people have a built-in bias to kind of lend more credence to that and give this piece of information the benefit of the doubt, if you will. So in that way, partisan motivated reasoning and our political identities don't only directly shape what we believe, but also how we treat new information that we're being presented with.
You've recently published some research on partisan motivated reasoning. Can you talk through some of your findings there?
Yeah, absolutely. So what we looked at, for example, we examined what are people's beliefs about Russian meddling in the 2016 presidential elections. So, right, it's well known that there was a Russian interference campaign to influence the outcome of the presidential race in 2016. That's been pretty well documented by investigative journalists, by scholars, by U.S. intelligence agencies. That's not controversial. What is controversial is, did this Russian influence campaign have any influence on the actual outcome of the presidential race 6 years ago? And here we find that people in the United States have very differing views. Some Americans think that, yeah, Russia's interference campaign didn't just take place, but it tipped the scales in the presidential race. Some people believe that the only reason why Donald Trump became president in 2016 is because Russia had that interference campaign. Other people and other scholars come to the different conclusion. They say, you know, Russia's influence campaign took place, but it didn't really have any meaningful impact on the actual vote tally at the end. Now, what we find is essentially that one big reason why some people believe this in the United States and others don't is because of the identities that they hold. We find that at the most fundamental level, Democrats are the ones who are most likely to say Russia tipped the scales Russia's influence campaign was decisive, Republicans are most likely to say, nope, Russia's interference campaign might have happened, but it didn't actually have a meaningful effect on the vote tally.
That's really interesting. What about character traits? What role do they play?
Yeah, so the research we've conducted on character traits is actually quite broad. We are a part of a massive growing field in political science that tries to uncover the deeply rooted personality characteristics that shape how people think and feel politically. So, for example, in India, we have found that people who have more positive views on the general trustworthiness of humans, so who think that humans can't be trusted, period, those people are much more willing to make compromises in India's territorial disputes than Indian citizens who have a kind of very skeptical view of human nature. Now, in the United States, the scholarship that I do with my co-authors tries to look beyond partisan identities, and we try to assess the kind of less easily observable factors that influence people's political views. And so I think that over the last few years, my co-authors and I have found a few really interesting things here. So most recently, we have found in actually the same paper I mentioned earlier, that not all Democrats and not all Republicans are equally likely to engage in partisan motivated reasoning. Instead, what's true is that the more you as an individual care about in-group loyalty in all aspects of your social life, the more likely you are to engage in motivated reasoning. So let me rephrase this. If you as a person care about standing up for your social groups in general, the more likely your brain is to give preferential treatment to arguments and viewpoints in favor of your political party. So in essence, what we find in this recent paper is that people's character traits, and in this case, how do they feel about their social in-groups, how strongly are they attached to their social in-groups in general, these character traits influence how much they engage in partisan-motivated reasoning.
So how attached people are to their social groups plays a big role. How else do these social networks affect us?
Yeah, so in my research over the last 8 years, I would say that social networks have emerged as sort of the third big driving force that influences how people process information, how they process political information in particular. And so I would say that at the most fundamental level, the insight that the research with my co-authors he has generated is that the types of people you surround yourself with influence your views on a bunch of different political issues. So I can provide some specific research findings perhaps here, and I can provide two good examples for this dynamic. So first, we did a study a few years ago. What we did in the study is we compared people who talk about politics in very homogeneous social networks to citizens who discuss current events with a diverse group of friends. And what we found is that having political discussions in politically homogeneous online networks makes people more emotionally attached to the political candidates of their preferred party. So essentially, talking politics with co-partisans makes you more attached. It makes you less ambivalent about the politicians that run for office for your preferred party. The second recent study that we did about social networks, I'm not the lead author on this one. My amazing co-author, Bert Baumgartner, took the lead on this study. But what we did in a related study is we model how information about new political issues spreads across the country. And what we did in this analysis is we essentially say, how does political information disseminate in the United States whenever there is a novel political phenomenon? And what this work shows is that, again, the types of people individuals surround themselves with have a really big influence on the beliefs that they adopt about a very novel contemporary political issue. So, for instance, the types of people that you surround yourself with have a massive influence on what your views about the coronavirus were in early 2020. On a broader level, what this study suggests is essentially that in a country that is as politically fragmented as the United States, it is super easy to get opinion polarization on pretty much any newly emerging political issue. So even on issues that shouldn't be polarizing by nature of what the issues are, in the United States, given just the types of people that individuals in this country hang out with and the way in which people's social networks are structured, create a situation in which political polarization emerges really quickly about any kind of novel phenomenon that pops out on people's news feeds.
You've talked a lot about the things that influence us. What about the things that don't?
So that's a great question, and there are obviously lots of things that could be mentioned here. But thinking about this, I would say that perhaps the most surprising answer here is new information. So one of the common themes behind much of the research I've done with my co-authors over the last few years is that as soon as issues become politicized, providing people with new information does not cause them to update their views as much as you would think. So to give you a concrete example, perhaps, even if you tell people that the measles vaccine it's safe, and it's effective, and it's going to be good for your children, that's simply not going to change the minds of a lot of vaccine skeptic parents. Or another example, fact-checking people about the kind of the integrity of the 2020 presidential election, right? So we all know that there are some doubts in the American electorate about the integrity of the 2020 election, but there's no evidence to suggest this. And fact-checking people, telling people, look, Biden's win was legitimate. There is no evidence to suggest that any of the conspiracy theories that are out there are actually true. Providing people with this additional information doesn't really convince them otherwise. So interestingly enough, new information is not always as effective in changing people's minds as you would think.
Why is it that the other things you mentioned, like personal identities and social networks, have such a large influence on us while new information doesn't?
So I think there are lots of reasons for this. Off the top of my head, I would say that there are probably two major ones. The first one is motivated reasoning again, right? So people have this built-in bias to gravitate to arguments and perspectives that confirm whichever views they've already adopted. And people have a built-in bias to reject arguments and perspectives that challenge their worldviews. And so I think that makes it hard for novel information to do its job if it challenges beliefs that people already hold. But I think the other thing that needs to be mentioned here, I think there are two more things that need to be mentioned here. First, I think social media has something to do that with as well. So 20 to 30 years ago, people who had kind of minority views on issues, they were oftentimes sort of ostracized for their political beliefs, and they did not really have an opportunity to have their minority views on issues validated. So for example, if you were a vaccine skeptic, if you said that vaccines cause autism, for example, you might not actually have that many people in your social network who hold that same belief. But nowadays with social media, it's really easy for you as an individual to connect to like-minded groups online and have your minority views validated. So I think that gives people an opportunity to kind of reinforce their political beliefs, whichever incorrect beliefs and misperceptions they might have, and that helps them to kind of hold on to their misperceptions even when novel information comes in. The last thing here that doesn't apply to all issues, but many of them, I don't like the phrase post-truth era, because I don't think we live in a post-truth era. I still think there is truth and there is something that's not truth. But it is true that specifically right now in the kind of political discourse in this country, a lot of elites who in their kind of public appearances, make factually inaccurate statements as if they were facts, right? Well, can talk about this later on, right? I've done some research on attitudes towards democracy, for instance. But the fact that you have political elites who make demonstrably false statements and don't get challenged for this as much as they might certainly also contributes to this lack of effectiveness for novel information.
You also studied people's attitudes toward democracy. What influences that, and how do some of the concepts you walked us through here apply there?
Yeah, so this is one of the specific issue areas where identities, character traits, and social networks all come together. So globally speaking, some of the work that I've done shows that voters who identify with winning political parties, they are more supportive of their country's political institutions than voters who identify with losing parties. So again, identities matter in how people evaluate the state of democracy in their country. But beyond that, we see that people's character traits and their social networks can further increase this gap between supporters of winning parties and supporters of losing parties. So for example, in one of our papers, we find that if your preferred party just lost an election, and if most of your friends on social media voted for that same losing party, the kind of communal misery sharing that people engage in on social media actually makes people more negative about the state of their country's democracy. So commiserating with each other about having lost an election is kind of detrimental to how people feel about the state of democracy. More recently, perhaps, my co-authors and I have also started to work on a number of papers about concerns about electoral integrity. Now, there's a lot of work there that shows that people's views about democracy are driven to a large extent by how fair they think elections in their country are. And we see that over the last few years, Americans have developed doubts about electoral integrity. They have developed doubts about how fair elections are run here. And so where this doubt comes from depends on your political identity. So most significantly, some of the work that I've done collaboratively shows that for a lot of Republicans, Donald Trump's baseless claims about the 2020 election, they have a meaningful negative impact on the perceived fairness of the vote in 2020. But also, that research shows that Donald Trump's claims that the election was rigged have actually decreased people's general support for democracy as a system of government. So what we see here is that people's views about not just how well is democracy functioning, but how desirable is democracy as a system of government is influenced by what political elites say about the fairness of elections. And if political elites use statements to question the integrity of the election, that has meaningful negative effects.
Thanks so much for sharing your work. If you could leave us with one last lesson, what would it be?
When it comes to political issues, more so now than probably before, it is really important to rely on a diverse news diet and for a lot of contentious claims to really make sure that they are corroborated by several different sources and not just one or two, because we are increasingly living in a society where political elites know that misinformation can pay off, and as a result, they rely on misinformation to influence voters.
Well, thank you so much, Florian. It's been great to talk with you.
Thank you so much for having me. This was a lot of fun.
So, Lee, what did you think?
Oh my gosh. Emotionally, I was all over the place with this one. I mean, at some points, I was just very sad about kind of the state of things. But then he did offer, you know, hope, talking about, like, how we can, you know, check ourselves and figure out where our biases are. I mean, kind of one of the big things that was just kind of rolling through my mind is just how fickle people are when it comes to what we think and how we act. And on one hand, Americans and probably people in general are, you know, they want to support their team, support the people around them, you know, very much the in-group experience. You want to be part of that. That's kind of an innate human need. But then, especially Americans, we're very passionate about being independent and having independent thought and freedom to choose our own way of life, and sometimes that just does not mesh with kind of the in-group mentality, and it gets kind of all just knotted up together.
It was really neat to hear it described, like, how we process new information. It was a lot messier than I would assume. There's a lot of things that are influencing your decision that you might not assume as you live your day-to-day lives. It seemed like the concept that was like undergirding a lot of what we're talking about was the idea of rational thought and rational decision-making. We're presented with a stimulus, a problem in the world, and then we make a decision that reflects to the best of our ability the values that we're trying to channel. But it sounds like a lot of things muddy the waters in our decision, and it may not be, our decisions may not be as rational as we think they are. So I think what Florian highlights is a lot of blind spots in our decision makings, in ways that certain phenomena like your social in-groups or your personal characteristics or even motivated reasoning can seep into the decisions we make. Just knowing about this is really helpful to be able to be conscious as you make decisions and be aware what's influencing you.
Yeah, you always hope that, I mean, yes, you get a piece of information and you make a decision about it, and you always hope that, okay, the next piece of information comes along and you're putting the same amount of thought and reason into, okay, new piece of information, this is a totally separate decision than the previous decision I made, and I'm going to go from there. But apparently that is not how we work whatsoever. We really like to stick to our guns.
Yes, humans are a very interesting species. We do a lot of peculiar things.
Sigh, so true.
Thanks, Lee. And thank you all for listening to The Vandal Theory. You can visit us on our website at uidaho.edu/vandaltheory to learn more about our research. Email us at vandaltheory@uidaho.edu. We're on all the podcast platforms. Please rate, review, and subscribe. I'm Kyle Fawnensteel.
And I'm Lee Cooper.